Welcome to another episode of Thoughts from the Big Chair. Now, in this episode, we talk to Frode Odgaard, CEO of the Post Industrial Institute. Now, normally based in California, but currently joining us from what I can only assume is a rather chilly Norway. So welcome, Frode.
Great to be here.
Now, Frode, listeners may not have come across you or the Post Industrial Institute, so it'd be great to start with a little background on both.
Sure. Well, I'm in Norway because I'm on a family visit, which I usually am this time of the year, Christmas, New Year's. And I immigrated to Silicon Valley 30 years ago after starting a company, software company here in high school, and started a few companies since. My focus in my career increasingly became on finding the quote-unquote one best way to first develop complex software systems, and then I became very interested in organizational design about 15, 20 years ago. And then in 2004, I founded what is now called the Post-Industrial Institute, which is essentially a research and advisory firm, or a think tank, if you will. We advise corporates and private equity firms as well on the nature of technology disruption and all of the changes, which we'll talk about today, that are happening around us, how to navigate those changes and how to go on the offensive and create value.
And so tell me, what about, obviously we're stepping into 2022, or we have stepped into 2022. We're kind of now dealing with the continuation of the global pandemic. What are the implications for your clients from private equity and corporates from a board perspective? How are they starting to think, or how are you advising them to think about some of the challenges around, supply chains and the decentralization, the technological advancements now of boards and private equity companies need to really get their heads around?
Yeah, so there's three lenses, if you will, or three areas that we all people can look at. One is what's happening in your industry or adjacent industries in terms of disruption. And of course, there's been a lot of talk about technology disruption, of decentralization. We started talking about that, of course, long before the pandemic. That's driven by the internet and by smartphones. So new capital efficient business models become available because you can separate people and assets from firms and create these loosely coupled models. Then there are other sources of disruption, of course, now in industries as well, such as supply chain problems that are related to the pandemic and government regulation, some of which is related to the pandemic. And then the second area is what's happening inside the firm. So how do you best manage the firm? How do you organize work? Where is work being conducted? And of course, that's been going through a process of decentralization as well, accelerated by the pandemic, certainly. You also have generational changes, changes in attitudes about work. So millennials, for example, tend to expect more autonomy, more self-actualization in firms. And those who've started working from home, many of them quite like it. They don't want to go back to the old-fashioned model of work. And many people have also started doing freelancing. In the United States, a full 50% of millennials are doing full-time or part-time freelancing. And during the pandemic, we've had this phenomenon known as the Great Resignation, some of which is due to older people retiring early, but also people who quit and become contractors and freelancers because they prefer that independence. And then the third lens is really the wider world, the geopolitical situation, what's happening in terms of the policy environment, whether it's increasing regulation in terms of tech and tech skepticism. We can talk about that. And then you also have the return to protectionism, digital protectionism on the part of the EU, trying to keep disruptors from Silicon Valley out, and also physical protectionism. Trump introduced steel tariffs. Those steel tariffs are still in place under the Biden administration. So it's kind of a strange situation where, on the one hand, the world is decentralizing, and that's technology-driven, accelerated by the pandemic. On the other hand, we have these barriers, and we have these fissions in society and between countries that in many ways have gotten worse in the last 2 or 3 years. So it's a very confusing and stressed environment that you deal with on the board and executive strategy level, trying to figure out how to navigate all of this is not an easy task.
And we hear about hybrid working, and you've touched on the millennials. Is that genie out the bottle now? Do you think the hybrid working is going to continue? Are organizations just going to have to adapt and suck it up? Or what do you think is going to happen for board decision making and the creative process that you'd hope that you'd be able to get through face-to-face interaction, which seems to be dwindling now?
Well, board members, of course, have been, as it were, phoning it in for quite some time. It's not an unusual situation to do remote board meetings, especially when you have board members who are who reside around the world and so on. I think it's a natural way of working anyway, since we've since people have been able to work over the internet to have a mix of in person and remote. So hybrid isn't really anything new. It's just a matter of degree. And so the lockdowns have kind of forced the needle in one direction, and to the extreme where people literally could not go to the office. And now I think what we're finding is that there's some work where being together in person, that's actually been known for a while, is vastly more efficient if you are there in person. But there's also a great incentive now to come up with better software tools, which we can talk about as well, to help facilitate collaboration beyond the sort of flat screen tools we've had so far, using augmented reality and so on. And I think that's going to mature quite a bit over the next 3 to 5 years. That'll become very common.
Well, I mean, maybe we'll touch on that now. I mean, in terms of the technology and how organizations can and should adapt, I'm sure you're advising many organizations that are trying to find that new rhythm and way of working, and how technology can play a role in that.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of, as is always the case with change, so there's a lot of hype, a lot of fancy terminology. It actually helps to look more closely at what practitioners, managers, and boards are actually doing. And what has been the case for quite a while is there has been steady investment in modernization of businesses. And much of what's referred to as digital transformation is actually digital modernization. Very simple things like you have some sort of a legacy system that's running in your own data center, and you realize that you can use off-the-shelf software that runs in the cloud. And the company that really started that as a big way was Salesforce. But now I looked at our own financials for 2021, or our draft financials, which I'm reviewing. I looked at how much money we're spending, and I was quite surprised, at various SaaS offerings. And we have so many applications that are run in the cloud. We hardly have any that we subscribe to or pay, except maybe Microsoft Office that we pay for, that run on the actual computer. So that's become fairly mainstream. But transformation, really, we should expect something a bit deeper. That means we're changing the assumptions behind what the outside environment looks like. And of course, the pandemic has accelerated change in the outside environment. Or we're changing our assumptions about how firms should work. And the pandemic has affected that as well. So I think that's where, people are more humble when you ask them, well, what have you actually done to truly transform the company? And there isn't really much happening besides remote work, so far, and moving to the cloud. And there's a lot more that companies can and should be doing about that.
The low-hanging fruit is moving to the cloud and using remote working. I mean, personal experience is that a lot of organizations have used the pandemic to either increase prices or reduce service levels or both. I suppose that's everybody's looking for the opportunity to transform their business models, but how much is really around true digital transformation, or is it just a case of kind of trimming customer service, increasing wait times, and increasing prices?
Well, Taylorism is an old idea, the idea of standardizing work tasks, and later on we became better at standardizing how information is organized. And then we try to make things as efficient as possible in terms of the number of seconds or number of steps. And that was quite valid for the time, you know, after the second industrial revolution. But management thinking really evolved from that point to really start to encompass the relationship between people in the workplace and between leaders and people and how to structure organizations. And there's a lot more to it than just becoming more efficient. What we have seen with worsening customer service is actually a problem where you have people who are not showing up for work because they're sick, or the people who have left the company and it takes a while to hire new people. And in some industries, they're actually struggling to find new people. And so if you are in a work queue, you know, waiting for a customer service representative, it may not just be because they've cut the number of employees down. It could just be that the number of people who are available to help you is lower because of these labor market conditions that we're seeing. And actually, that's something that's forcing some larger companies to start thinking about automation faster than they otherwise would. And that's going to be something we'll see a greater investment into in the next few years in industries where in the last 5 or 6 years, at least in terms of the content that we've been producing, we've been talking about, you know, this is coming, and the robots that make hamburgers and so on. Well, now companies like McDonald's are actually investing money. They're moving beyond the pilot stage, you know, for those kinds of applications. So these changes were underway. They've been accelerated by the pandemic, and they will continue to accelerate once the pandemic eventually fades out.
Yeah, I mean, the industry I'm in at the moment is construction, which has been very impacted by labor shortages and supply chain issues throughout the pandemic, and is a classic one that is in need of greater digitization for economy, you know, essentially improvements across the economic and supply chain, but the economics as an industry, I mean, that most of the constructors are operating at kind of 1% or sub 1% margins. And so technology needs to play a bigger role in that.
Well, so construction is a great example of an industry that where the complexity of production has kept increasing. And so I saw a quote somewhere that and we haven't studied the construction industry in depth, so I'm kind of risking it now, giving you this unsourced quote. But I saw a quote that said that the construction industry had not seen any productivity increase for the last 40 years. And now it's technologically much more capable, of course. And, you know, there's IT for project management, and there's more high-tech equipment now. But one of the challenges with construction is that everything tends to be so custom. And people, the customers, kind of used to everything being so custom. And this aesthetically, we expect not every building to look the same. And so this is a difficult thing to fight against. So I think until, you know, we have proper atomic precision level manufacturing and nanotechnology, and we can just grow buildings, you know, in a day, which will happen, you know, I think in our lifetime, we will continue to have that problem in construction. There, what we have known and what we've talked about for some years is how the end game for all production is local manufacturing. So if you think of the Star Trek replicator, you know, that is sort of the ultimate endpoint, right? Where you tell the machine that can make anything from its raw materials, here's something I want, and it puts it together for you right there. And then you need to have a matter feed or multiple matter feeds into that machine. And so what we're going through is a series of technology architectures moving us in that direction. And so at one point, manufacturing technology and the way factories worked made it sensible to do, and many industries still make it sensible to do outsourcing of production in mass quantities to some location far away with lower labor cost. And actually what happens as a side effect of that is over time, the engineering expertise needed in the factory, not just the workers, that expertise goes up and its availability locally where you are goes down because you've outsourced to these companies that are building up the expertise. And so that's one of the challenges of moving manufacturing out of China, which is becoming more attractive both for security policy reasons and, you know, and protectionism and trust issues, basically. It can't be done overnight for a lot of products because you don't have the equipment, the expertise at home. Building a new fab, for example, speaking of the tech industry and microprocessors again, it takes, you know, 2, 3, 4 years. It costs $2-3 billion. And it takes, you know, it takes a lot of expertise. And so, but I think we're moving towards slowly but surely localizing production. So, and eventually it's going to be, you know, a micro factory in your neighborhood and an even smaller unit that you have at home. And 3D printing is sort of the very first sort of primitive example of that. But we'll have more advanced technology going down the road. And really it's dictated by just supply chain economics. If you have fewer steps on the way, you know, less travel time, less cost, less inventory storage, all of that points its way towards production at the site of consumption or purchase.
Yeah, clearly there's an environmental and sustainability point on that as well.
Yeah, and so what you have to factor in there is how different jurisdictions will deal with that issue as well, right? And so the decisions that they make are not always in tune with science, although they like to just say that the science is settled when they have to use justification. And that's happening with the pandemic as well. And then, of course, then there's an update. We get higher precision information, right? And then typically lawmakers and regulators are always lagging, you know, the actual knowledge. And so that's a challenge for investors and for managers in all jurisdictions is how do they navigate that. But the more you localize, the less exposure you have to having to go through literally other jurisdictions on the way. So, and what that means is that what's going to be transported is the digital recipe for what you are making and raw materials. If they don't have them locally, you're not going to be transporting the assembled product.
And we talked about, you touched earlier on about the generational aspect of this. We touched on particularly the ways of working and the environmental concerns that that people have. And what are your thoughts on how the generational shift as the millennials get older and become more senior in the workplace? What impact will that have on organizations and decision making?
Well, there's a new generation coming after the millennials and the post-millennials. They have similar attitudes. They actually tend to be slightly more risk-averse than the millennials. And one theory about that is that they grew up when we had the real estate collapse about 12 years ago. And so they didn't grow up in a time that was prosperous in their childhood as that of millennials. And but in general, of course, when people get older and they settle down, they have kids and so on, they may not want to work as much. I think millennials now have already made the shift to more autonomy being granted by employers, and employers still don't understand that they're not going to find any less desire for autonomy and self-actualization in the generation that comes after the millennials. If anything, it's going to get higher. But the post-millennials may look for more safety because of the way that they've grown up. So it's hard to say that. I find that we have to kind of look at generational shifts with, you know, a little bit of skepticism, because there are things that are true in the aggregate, but then they vary by culture, by, you know, in different jurisdictions, and then there are developments that can accelerate or decelerate certain trends as well. What's important for firms and for managers is that they have to understand that they have to be able to adapt to what the talent wants, how the talent wants to work. The shift in power, if you will, from organizations to individuals, that's already happened. That's irreversible. The threshold for starting a new firm of your own with some friends and quickly getting it funded, even using new mechanisms like cryptocurrency, that threshold is lower than ever. And we'll never get back to a time where, oh, starting your own company, that was a big deal, and that was only something rich people did. And you know, that's an irreversible change. And organizational lifespans are also not increasing, right? So because the pace of innovation is contributing to killing off companies that can't keep up with change, either through bankruptcy or through acquisition. So they disappear as independent entities. So what that means is the way we think about firms is going to become more like the way we think about movies. It's a project. It has a limited lifespan. It might have a long tail in terms of the payout over time, if there's intellectual property there, like for movies. But it's not something, we're not developing firms as, you know, as institutions, the way we used to think about, you know, long-lasting, noble firms. And a lot of thinking hasn't really caught up with that. If you think about the whole idea of corporate social responsibility that sort of made a comeback from its from the initial wave that we had in the 1970s, I think it was, it's completely out of place now. It has no place in modern business whatsoever, because firms, first of all, are and we have to go back to the foundation of why we have firms. It's a collaborative arrangement of capital and talent to produce value for customers and owners. And you have to treat people well, otherwise you will not get people to work for you. And many of them are going to be your fellow shareholders to actually execute on this stuff. But firms are not institutions that are there to last, you know, for generations. That is a medieval way of thinking about organizations, right? And we still, many people, I'm not one of them, have this romanticized idea of organizations that just staying alive for the purpose of improving, you know, the economy around them and so on. We have to really let go of that. The people who improve the economy where they live are the people who live there. It's not their firms. And so that's going to be up to individuals in terms of their, you know, their individual efforts. But firms are becoming and are going to become much more ephemeral. They're not going to be tied on to a location as much, unless you have physical assets in a location. And much more of the economic value produced will be intellectual. It will be information. It will not be so much physical assets. So physical assets, production, all of that's becoming more and more of a commodity, and more of the value is shifting to the intellectual product that we can create.
We'd be remiss, based on where you normally spend most of your week, not to talk about artificial intelligence. It's obviously a major impact on the future of work. Any thoughts on that, based on how quickly it's being adopted and whether it will become, you know, mainstream in most organizations?
Yeah, it's interesting. So AI sort of both overhyped and underestimated. In one sense, when people talk about data science and spotting patterns in data and so on, well, all of that's been going on since the 1980s. The terminology has shifted, the capability has improved over time, but it's not a dramatically new thing. It's just that it's become more mainstream. And so for some technologies, it just becomes, the internet's contributing to this, it becomes more popular. It becomes more accessible. There are more, you know, user-friendly development tools available. There are courses available. Anyone can learn to use these tools. It's all open source. You can get to very low-cost capacity from Amazon and Google, and you can try it a whole bunch of things. When it comes to AI in application for, say, you know, automating away jobs and automating tasks and so on, it's just there's a bunch of hard work that has to be done in each case. You know, you have to train a network. Then you actually find, when you look into some of the case stories, IBM is a company that's sinned a bit in this regard. When you actually look at what's required to implement all of this, well, there's a fair amount of old-fashioned programming in addition to the machine learning to create these applications. So we're still going to need people people for that. But I think what we're going to see is robotics maturing, and some of these unpleasant and some dangerous tasks being done using robots as tools are being done wholesale by robots. But I think in terms of intellectual work, we're going to see sort of a new generation of very capable applications that are using machine learning in a way where they can act as an addition to the capability of human knowledge workers. Because if you look at most software applications up till now, there are all some variants of a word processor, a spreadsheet, you know, a database. You know, it's like, well, they might be a more specialized version of a database, a spreadsheet, a word processor, or some sort of workflow tool. But that's kind of the story of the software industry, gaming aside, you know, for the last several decades. Yeah, it's moved to different, better user interfaces, to, you know, Windows and so on. It's moved to the cloud now. But the dream really is to have the machine act as sort of more like your intelligent partner who can help you with things. And there's a very modest tool I'd like to point out, because we're both working on books. It's called Grammarly. And so they're making use of machine learning to help people make suggestions for rephrasing sentences and so on. And that's completely machine learning based. And they're spending heavily expending a lot of effort on that. And that's not something you could have done using old-fashioned rule-based software where you write the code, you know, for each case, you have an if statement and so on. It wouldn't work. And just something very modest like that can make a tremendous difference. And so you'll see those kinds of applications kind of sneaking everywhere and just make our lives better. And if you're an entrepreneur, there's so many opportunities to create value in every realm of life just using modest contributions like that.
So I guess final question then, Fred, when you're talking to your clients, what are the two or three things that you advise them to look out for in 2022?
Well, I'm not sure that's new for this year, but we've been saying this for a while that boards need to become technology literate. They actually, more recently, we started using the term disruption literate, because it's tech disruption, but it's also supply chain disruption. There's all of these other things happening. A good friend of mine in London, she did a study on the composition of publicly traded companies in the London Exchange. And she found that virtually none of them had an engineering background. Right, so they're all accountants, they're lawyers, marketing, finance people. So that's a significant handicap, because when you move to maybe the second thing I'd mention is that the executive team needs to have a real transformation strategy in place, which goes beyond modernization. You have to think about changing the structure of the firm, is changing the business models where their revenue are going to come from, changing the relationship with their employees, real enterprise transformation. We talk about the post-industrial enterprise, where the enterprise itself is becoming increasingly decentralized. The management has to have that in place. And to tie to the first element, it's very difficult to do that if you have a board that doesn't really understand any of these things in depth. And so that means you have to spend some effort on educating the board. We're doing some things in that area. We're going to be launching something called the Post-Industrial Academy. So I'm very passionate about empowering boards so that they can hold management accountable and, frankly, also help guide the management to make sure that there's a strategy that will both sufficiently transform the enterprise and produce shareholder value as you're doing that. And there's often a kind of a disconnect between the board and the management. So those would be the two most important things. And if I was going to tack on a third, it would be people are more important than ever. This is something I would have said every year since I got in business, except maybe the first few years, because I don't think I was too young. I don't think I understood it. But now people long for human connection. Young people want to be part of a mission that they can feel passionate about. And I'm not talking about some sort of altruistic, politically correct thing, save the whales, or I'm not talking about that kind of a mission. I'm talking about something that they can be part of that makes a difference in the world where they can, to customers. You know, it's customer, you know, people sort of forget this. They get all excited about employees volunteering for and doing good work and so on in society. Well, your customers, that's where you should be doing your good work. Mm-hmm. And you should be doing something with your customers that's different enough, that's exciting enough, that young people will want to come and stay with you and work with you to work on that. And so I think it's time for a lot of companies to take a look at their mission statement, at their vision, now that the outside environment is changing so dramatically, to update that. And because if you are a 50-something, 60-something executive, and your kids would not want to work for the company that you run, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
That's my bottom line. That's a good question to ask them at the breakfast table. You know, here's what we're doing. You know, this is exciting to you. And if they're like, I don't know, they go back to their phone, you're in trouble. So.
Well, particularly on some of the points you're talking about the great resignation, where people have got lifestyle choices and other ways in which they can earn money through the side hustles that they can pull together. So, you know, just that point around trying to attract people to your organization, trying to make sure you've got the EVP for your organization, because you're competing not just with competing organizations for the talent, but actually getting people to work for larger organizations in the first place.
Yeah. So it's interesting that I think larger organizations underestimate how vulnerable they are to their best talent just going somewhere else, not because they get paid more, but because it's just less boring. And I think what you'll find is, you know, if I'm a 28-year-old, and, you know, I got to say, I got a computer science education, and I'm like, you know, maintaining some legacy system, you know, yeah, it pays the rent, but is that what I want to do with my life? No. So I might go take a big pay cut and work for a friend who has a startup, or maybe join a startup, be part of doing a startup. That's doing something I find exciting. If I have a little bit of money saved up, you know, I'll do it. Or just losing talent to another large company, that's just a little bit less boring.
so be less boring is the
well, no, it's more, I don't think that's sufficient, because you can, you know, you can bring in comedians and you can entertain people and so on. It's more, people understand, you know, lifespan is limited, at least for now. That's an engineering problem that we'll solve eventually, hopefully in the next few decades. But life for now, life is limited. You can choose what to fill it with. I think the internet has made it more apparent to young people the vast range of choices that are available to them and the different outcome people have. You know, with social media, they get to watch, you know, the beautiful people with washboard abs on the beach. And also they get to interact with people who have not taken well care of themselves. And then you have reality shows. And so we have this idea that many things can happen in life. And if you can offer people for something to do that connects with what they think is generally fun and that they would be good at, you're going to draw those people to you.
Yeah.
And I think that what happens to large companies after, you know, after the original founders are gone, because the founders may have had that spirit, is the company becomes essentially a mechanism for producing returns for shareholders. And companies can survive that way a long time if they operate, you know, they're operated in a competent way. But now two things are making that very difficult. We're making that very difficult. And that was before the pandemic arrived. One was technology disruption, primarily decentralization enabled by the internet and smartphones and so on. So big disruption in business models as a result. And two, changing expectations among workers. So more, they want more independence, more autonomy, more self-actualization. You can't beat that with efficiency. What you have to do is you have to think about, what is this company for? You kind of have to go back to the, if the founders are not around anymore, you know, let's say they passed away 50 years ago, you really have to embark on an exercise to better understand the changing environment, you know, the changing business environment around us. And that's, there are generational changes, technology disruption, supply chain disruption. I mentioned protectionism, geopolitical threats. You know, our security architecture in Europe might be in for a very unpleasant change. You know, there's China, there's all this stuff happening. You have to take that all of that into account, and you have to take into account what your would-be employees will be excited to work on in terms of all of these problems. And you kind of have to reinvent yourself that way. That is a real transformation. Then you know, all the organizational design, the IT technology, all of that, that's a means to the organization doing what it is that you want it to do. But the soul of the company has to be kind of reinvented. And that's an exercise that a lot of boards and executive teams hesitate to embark on, because, well, what's the investor relations aspect of that? You're just going to come back on a Tuesday and tell them, look, we're an entirely different company now. This is a very serious exercise. So if you can avoid it, you know, they don't want to do it. But I think for many companies, it has to be done. Otherwise, in another 5-10 years, they won't be around.
Yeah. Well, Frode, fantastic insights there. We touched on a lot of things: decentralization, disruption, generational change, geopolitical challenges. But ultimately, I think we've finished on a note which is absolutely poignant, which is about purpose, passion, and people. So thank you for sharing those insights, and I appreciate you coming on the episode.
Always fun to talk with you, Russell. Thanks for having me.